Citizens United is just the most recent stop in a long run of cases extending corporate civil rights. Perhaps the right to vote, the corporate right to bear arms, and corporate religion, as in Nikeism, Microsoftianity, and the Bank of America Church of the Mortgage Redeemer, are just over the constitutional horizon. But before we all work ourselves into a storm the Bastille lather, let us pause and look around and look at ourselves. Corporations are often as small and as local as they are large and multinational. They're like the zombie armies of the undead. They are here, they are everywhere, and they are sitting right next to you. Chances are very good that your neighborhood store is a corporation, as is your local restaurant, as is the local hardware store and the local auto repair shop down the street. Moreover, most large-scale projects in the United States occur in part because the entrepreneurs can undertake them as corporations. Now, without making a qualitative judgment whether some or any of the following are truly good things, consider that no shopping center, no high-rise office building or housing development, no communications network, no Hollywood movie, no computer manufacturer, no aircraft manufacturer, that means Boeing, no magazine, no gambling casino, no auto dealership, no gas station, no supermarket, no military weapons manufacturer, no offshore deep water drilling entity, none of them would come to be if they could not be undertaken in the form of a corporation. Consider furthermore how many of us have actually been co-opted into the corporate system through deliberate tax policy of forcing you and me and many to stash your so-called retirement accounts into KEO 401k or IRA accounts. And how many middle-class homes go home every night, especially this night, religiously to check their portfolio on the New York or NASDAQ stock exchanges, concerned that if our corporate stock holdings fall in value, we may have to work until the day we die. Which begs the question whether you, as a shareholder of any corporation, really want to be personally liable for the misdeeds of the company whose stock you own in your own retirement accounts. It's a question of whether you really want your companies that you own to spend more on eleemosynary activities and less on pumping up the value of your retirement account. In short, the population in general in the United States has taken the bait, and they are now part of the profit-driven capitalist political economic system, and we are, as a nation, hooked on large corporations and Wild West capitalism, just as though we were an economic heroin junkie. Consider also, when we are talking about First Amendment rights, that a right in and of itself is just an empty state of mind, unless one has the means to enforce that right. Thus, if a mere pipsqueak person chooses to enforce his or her constitutional rights in a court of law, one first needs to have the proverbial good case, and then find a lawyer who will either take your case on a pro bono basis, which means at no charge, or you need to have sufficient money to hire counsel for the long and arduous and expensive journey that will take you through the court system. Big corporations, however, can always pay for counsel to address their civil rights, which is why large companies are not shy about suing municipal governments, counties, regulatory agencies, the federal government, and community groups when these entities or when these companies believe that the rights they hold dear, that is, their right to make money, is in jeopardy. Remember that the Citizens United group itself, and by the way, two members of the board of directors of Citizens United are actually from Washington State, and one of them, Kirby Wilbur, or Wilbur Kirby, is actually a former disc jockey for KJR Radio in this local area. That group, Citizens United, paid about $1.5 million in attorney's fees in order to get its case eventually heard by the United States Supreme Court. Therefore, when you consider the practicalities of actually enforcing your civil rights, money is the enforcer. Wherefore, some could argue large corporations actually have more rights than any of the rest of us. In earlier Supreme Court cases, the justices have held that money is the equivalent of free speech. And if money equals speech and the money put into corporate speech is uncontrollable, then money might as well equate to votes. When money talks, politicians listen. The problem is not so much freedom of speech as the freedom to be heard. If all you have is the right to speak, but no one can hear you, then your free speech is no better than a little schizophrenic voice whispering quietly in your own head to yourself. Now, we're not talking about the right to force people to hear what you want to say. We're talking about the realistic opportunity to be heard. The reality in our far-flung nation of 300 millions of people and our global empire of billions around the globe is that speech without the ability to be heard is meaningless. In our profit-driven, capital-intensive system, the only way you can be effectively heard is if you buy your access to the public ear. The bigger your mouth, the louder your speech. To have a big mouth these days means you have to have a lot of money to spend. Even if you can save all your pennies and mortgage your home, and you buy some TV airtime or an ad in the local struggling newspaper, or you're able to do some street theater, your speech will be blown away by the sheer media onslaught, the volume, the repetitiveness, the slickness, the skillfully manipulative speech of the deep corporate pockets. Nor is the internet enough, because there too the big pipes are owned by just a few monstrous telecommunications companies. And you should never assume that the internet will always be free or accessible, unmonitored or uncensored. Nor can you be sure that you will always be able to post content to YouTube or anywhere else, because the media giants and the RIAA, that's the Recording Industry Association of America, have served notice that they will sue the pants off anyone who infringes their seemingly interminable copyrights. Furthermore, you have no assurance that you will always have free access to the web, because the large media corporations seem intent on destroying the net neutrality of the web by giving preferential bandwidth and speed to the biggest and wealthiest users. Indeed, the internet was created by the government at public expense, and now the private for-profit sector acts like it owns it, which, thanks to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, maybe it does. Likewise, your speech on the web can be just as drowned out by the volume and intensity and coordination of the corporate message, and the dissenting voice, the alternative point of view, can be blown away just as easily in the ether as in the traditional state media. Yes, you can put in extraordinary time and effort. You can organize a few hundred of your friends to stage a demonstration for which you will be required to obtain a permit for some weekend afternoon where no one will see you and no media will give you more than 30 seconds coverage, and where, if you are lucky, you will not be enclosed in a razor wire free speech zone. Not all of us see the same problem. Our friends at the American Civil Liberties Union, and they are much of the time our friends, filed a friend of the court brief with the U.S. Supreme Court in Citizens United, supporting the free speech rights of corporations. From the perspective of the ACLU, limitations on free speech of any kind are a slippery slope for everyone. Therefore, the limitations on free speech inevitably leads to tyranny, and wherever there is more free speech, everyone wins. After all, limitation on corporate political speech would also limit the speech of labor unions or of NGOs like the Sierra Club. From the perspective of the ACLU, If you would only join a large NGO, NGO like the ACLU, the NAACP, the Sierra Club, or the AFL-CIO, and give them your money and your energy, then you too will have the same speech rights that corporations have. The Citizens United decision is about 95 pages long, including all the headnotes and the dissents and everything else. But here's a quick and dirty distillation of the five-judge majority opinion in the case. One, political speech is good, therefore the more political speech, the better. Two, the government cannot restrict speech based on who is speaking, whether the speaker is a corporation, a union, an association, an NGO, or an individual. Three, the First Amendment right of political speech does not depend on your financial status or lack of status. That is, wealthy people have just as much a right of political free speech as do poor people, which means that you too can buy a multi-million dollar TV network political advertising campaign just like Warren Buffett, if he were to do so. So everything's equal. Next, the high cost, this is in the opinion of the Supreme Court, the high cost of running for public office is irrelevant. I'll repeat that. The high cost of running for public office is irrelevant. Next, the government ought not to tell voters who has their interests in mind and who does not, or what is true and what is false. Rather, let everyone speak and entrust the people to decide for themselves. Bookmark that thought as we go through this discussion. Next, the appearance of corruption or money facilitating access to or influence over politics will not discourage people's belief in the political system. In other words, the amount of money coming in will not discourage you from participating in the political system. And ultimately, the fact that corporations are trying to influence the people's vote proves that in the final analysis, it is the people's vote that matters most, not the money spent to influence that vote. In sum, according to the Supreme Court, the people are still sovereign. And what that means by being sovereign is that the people are the boss. They're in control, because no matter how much money is spent by corporations to influence them, it is still the people's vote that makes them the boss and puts them in control. Now, in order to get inside the minds of the Citizens United majority opinion, I suggest people think in terms of what I call free market politics. Free market politics is like Milton Friedman's Chicago School of Free Market Capitalism. Free market politics, as the Supreme Court majority would consider it, essentially means that there is not just a free market of ideas, but a free market in the dissemination of those ideas. But like in the business world, the natural evolution of free market capital and the natural evolution of free market speech is the development of bigger and bigger and more monopolistic monoliths that dominate the arena. In the business world, it leads to the current situation on Wall Street with a shrinking number of bigger and bigger banks, the unregulated hyper-financial bubbles of the derivatives markets and hedge funds, a shrinking number of bigger and bigger media conglomerations, fewer and fewer automobile companies. There used to be 30, 40, 50 automobile manufacturers in the U.S. in the 1930s and 40s. Now there may be two. It leads to the phenomenon of today's cable and satellite television, where you have thousands and thousands of channels with less and less substantive content. In short, free market politics, like free market economics, ineluctably leads to less variety and less substance in political speech, not more. The problem is that equating money with speech naturally leads to an arms race. If the only way one can be heard is to amalgamate with others in bigger and bigger groups so that you can raise more and more money for more and more expensive media campaigns, then eventually only the very biggest groups will ever be heard. Yes, the best funded, quote, liberal groups will be heard. The Sierra Club will be heard. The ACLU will be heard. MoveOn.org will be heard, as will the best-funded conservative groups, such as the Chamber of Commerce, the Republican National Committee, and James Dobson's focus on the family. They will have no problems. The natural result of this arms race, however, is that individuals, remember the people that Rebecca was talking about, the people about whom the Bill of Rights is all about, individuals simply cannot compete with the big players. Worse, the process of getting bigger necessarily means a process of homogenization of ideas, because all big voluntary organizations necessarily have to develop the middling consensus in order to keep from being pulled apart. This inevitably leads to the self-censorship of the non-consensus points of view, and in addition, it also leads to a process where, unlike consensus, where you need to have consensus to get things done, in free speech, what you want to have is the ability to hear the minority point of view as well as the majority point of view. In short, the process of homogenizing speech by forcing people to only speak in large, well-funded groups is a surefire way to shrink the political dialogue to the point of antiseptic but politically irrelevant cocktail conversation. Let us consider a more fundamental point. The only speech worth defending is that of the minority, because the opinions and views of the majority do not need to be defended. The process of consensus building within any organization is necessarily the process of constructing a majority opinion. And in the process of building consensus, the individual point of view always gets discarded. The Supreme Court is, in essence, encouraging us to ally in groups to practice group think and group speech. For the consensus of the group is always less dangerous than that of the free-thinking and free-speaking individual. And I'd like to return to the central thread of the majority opinion in Citizens United. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a sense, is tweaking our noses with our own platitudes and notions of democracy. You say the people are sovereign. You say we're the boss. You say we live in a democracy where the people rule. You say that people are smart enough to govern themselves. You say that we are all created equal. You say that you want power to the people. You say that might doesn't make right, that the pen is mightier than the sword, and that money can't buy you love. All right, says the majority of the Supreme Court, if you are that smart, that equal, that clever, and that powerful, then you can figure it out for yourselves. What is true and false, good and bad, naughty and nice, and you do not need a meddlesome, paternalistic government to protect you from big, bad corporations. And that, in essence, is what the Supreme Court is saying. Caveat emptor, or caveat votor, says the majority of the Supreme Court, as it piles on the bromides of free market democracy. Let the voter beware. On the face of it, this is a noble thought. But the reality is that some referee has to be able to blow the whistle when a foul has been committed, or the game will be nothing more than like TV wrestling with the strong beating up on the weak. Essentially, the Supreme Court is dissing the Ralph Nader philosophy that it is wrong for corporations to suborn the public interest by ubiquitous advertising, sexy product packaging, and slick marketing campaigns. The majority of the Supreme Court is saying, in a manner of speaking, that when it comes to political speech, it is not the government's business to prevent GM from selling a Corvair that flips over at 35 miles an hour, or to tell Toyota not to sell a car that accelerates to highway speeds on its own. And it is especially not the government's business to protect you from the excesses of corporate political propaganda. The Supreme Court majority holds that the very fact corporations spend so much money trying to influence the people's vote proves that our vote is what really matters. But viewed through the other end of the telescope, corporations spend so much money trying to influence your vote precisely because they know that it works. You have only to look at what happened during the recent debacle about health care reform to understand how effective is the power of money applied to political processes and the manipulation of public opinion. to understand how well they understand how to manipulate us, you have only to look at how easily Madison Avenue has persuaded us to buy what we don't want, what we don't need, and what we cannot afford. The institutions of many states, Inquisition Spain, Stalin's USSR, Hitler's Third Reich, the military-industrial institutions of our own Bush-Obama continuum, how easily they have been able to break strong men's and women's wills, twist their minds, persuade them to confess the most improbable crimes, persuade people that less is more, war is peace, that freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, because we have all been caused to seek succor and comfort from fear and the smothering embrace of the security state. The real issue posed by the Supreme Court's somewhat ironic commentary is, what does it mean to be sovereign? What does it mean to be the boss? Are the people sovereign? Are you? Am I? To be sovereign means to be independent and unlimited by any other authority. Do the majority of people even want to be sovereign? In light of what you believe about the majority of Americans, do you want the people to be sovereign? What does this say about democracy? What does it say about majority rule? During the American War of Independence, and I call it the War of Independence because it was not a revolution, not even a majority of the colonials at that time favored independence. The majority were either apolitical, apathetic, or they were Tories who favored remaining loyal British colonies. In short, they were like a majority of our own society today. Socially conservative, interested in preserving their own material best interests, and wary of change. Human nature favors the conservation of energy, which translated into the political sphere means that people would rather conserve energy by sitting on a couch, watching television, chugging beer, than put the energy into such esoteric things as we're talking about today. And who am I, who are you, to tell them to do otherwise? Consider your own genetic progeny. It makes for a more evolutionary, sensible strategy to keep your head low in your foxhole than to demand liberty or death, for history proves that you are far more likely to achieve the latter than the former. So long as people have their jobs, meaningless though they might be, their job-related health care benefits, their mortgage-encumbered homesteads, their barbecues, their video games, their drugs of choice, their big-screen TVs, their 401ks, the possibility that their children might have a chance to go to college and advance themselves a little up the social ladder, then the bulk of the people, if not necessarily content, will not rebel. It won't be like Greece. Then why should they care whether they are or are not sovereign? Why should they care whether some multinational corporations or gangs of corporations runs their lives? People should care, because large corporations will now use their unlimited moneyed speech to elect politicians who will further offshore their jobs, foreclose more of their homes, liquidate more of their 401ks to pay the investment bank executives, and put the price of a college education beyond the reach of their children. And when you fall ill, without any coherent single-payer universal health care system, we will still be bankrupted by the medical system. Indeed, with only limited moneyed speech, they've already done most of these things. Prior to Citizens United, with the fig leaves still in place in our mythical free speech Garden of Eden, people could claim they did not know how disadvantaged they were. But the Supreme Court has now ripped off the fig leaves. And can the people still deny that they are completely naked? This was the deal made with the American people after the United States emerged as the sole victor at the end of the Second World War. The people would stay out of the governance business, and business would take care of the people. It is Fordism, a form of corporate benevolence granted in exchange for ceding sovereignty to big business. Fordism is a kind of benevolent dependency. It is a parent-child relationship where the corporation is your wise daddy Warbucks, And we, the citizens, are the dependents, the immature children who have to be led, who have to be told what is in our best interests, and a democracy that has to be managed for its own good. And so it has been in the U.S. since about 1945. Being sovereign, that is, being the boss, being in control, is the antithesis of being dependent. A sovereign people that can govern itself does not depend on corporations, or for that matter on the government, for their jobs. A sovereign does not accept benefits granted by others. A sovereign does not plead, does not beg, does not petition, does not complain about what is fair or unfair. A sovereign does, takes, demands, mandates, and acts. So are the people really sovereign or not? The problem has been addressed in different ways by different peoples. The Bolsheviks created a dictatorship of the proletariat to guide and govern the people until they could learn how to govern themselves, right? But the people did not learn, and the Stalinist dictators became the new governing elites. The French Revolution became a bourgeois revolution, and then it became an empire. Sacre bleu. The Chinese Revolution threw out the capitalist regime, and now, 50 years later, China is more capitalist than America. And who are we who refuse to pay obeisance to a British aristocracy back in 1776, and who now bow down to a new aristocracy that inherits wealth and power and lords it over us as so many ennobled corporations? If the people object to the premise of Citizens United, that the things are the way they are, then are the people really ready, willing, and able to assume their own sovereignty? Assuming the people are not sovereign, then the real issue is, how do the people become sovereign? How do you become in charge? It is not just a matter of changing the law, for the Supreme Court has decreed that the issue is constitutional in nature, and the mere laws of Congress yield to the Constitution as the Supreme Court interprets it. You can amend the Constitution to strip personhood from corporations or even mandate 10-year terms for Supreme Court justices, but that would require a two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress and confirmation by three-quarters of the state legislatures or a constitutional convention called by two-thirds of the states and approved by three-quarters of the state legislatures. And I don't quite see the groundswell of support for this among either the Democratic or Republican Party leadership. You can employ the impeachment procedure to remove members of the Supreme Court, but impeachment is apparently a constitutional process as quaint and outdated as the Geneva Convention, so according to Alberto Gonzalez, and perhaps as outdated as that exclusive constitutional power of Congress to declare war. Remember, that's in the Constitution as well. Rarely used, if ever, anymore. You can even daydream about packing the Supreme Court, as Franklin Roosevelt sought to do in 1937 by adding up to six new justices. But that's just daydreaming. The bottom line is that there is no political power or free speech without political sovereignty. The ravenous lions will not lie down with the lambs except to eat them. And if the meek inherit the earth, it will be an earth covered in BP's oil. It is not about exercising political power or about persuading anyone to do anything. It is a matter of maturing into power. One earns sovereign status, or you assume it, or you create it for yourself. It cannot be given to you.